From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today on the show, looming challenges when it comes to the city's water and sewer systems.
Plus the effort to recruit more mental health nurses in Milwaukee.
Later, Journal Sentinel book critic Jim Higgins gets some advice on who to include in his book about Wisconsin's literary luminaries.
Really and truthfully, one of the helpful lists of Wisconsin writers is at the Central Library in downtown Milwaukee, where they have Wisconsin Writers Wall of Fame. And that was a list I kept coming back to every once in a while as I thought about who.
And singer-songwriter Mike Mangione shares the surprising story of an interview he did with two of his musical heroes.
I was so nervous because I look up to these people so much. And I open up the dressing room door, and there they are. And my heart starts racing like a geek. You know, like I'm so like, I'm dorking out here.
Lake Effect comes your way next, right after the news. Good morning, this is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Out of sight and out of mind, that's the typical dynamic when it comes to the pipes that bring us drinking water or the system that takes storm and wastewater out of our homes and neighborhoods. But things change when there's a crisis.
The Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum has released a report that makes the point that we're all going to need to consider the condition of our water and sewer systems. It's the latest in a series of reports on the state of Milwaukee's infrastructure.
Forum President Rob Henkin and researcher Ben Juarez join us in the studio to share what they concluded. Welcome to you both.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Mitch.
So this is going to sound like a ridiculous statement, but obviously our water and sewer infrastructure has been aging for a long time. Why are we seemingly at a precipice at this point in time?
Well, I think it really depends on which parts of the infrastructure we're looking at here. In the case of the Milwaukee Metropolitan Sewerage District, we're not necessarily at a precipice. The deep tunnel was constructed not too long ago. We find that most of the major assets are in pretty good condition. There is certainly some work that needs to be done at the reclamation facilities. But again, that's not the precipice. I think the real precipice here, and we can get into talking about the city sewers, but really is city water and the Milwaukee Water Works. And it's a combination of two factors. Number one, the water mains are indeed aging, and they do need to significantly enhance their replacement schedule for the water mains. And then, of course, the big elephant in the room is the emergence of the lead service line issue, where up until a few years ago, while certainly there was a recognition that eventually, over many, many, many years, those lines would need to be replaced, I think now there's an imperative to go much faster.
The issue of lead in our drinking water is on the radar of a lot of people. Would you say, does this represent the largest portion of the pie at this point?
It represents the largest portion in terms of the length of time it will take to get this done. So it all depends. In the report, we are going off of what we are being told by the Milwaukee Water Works, and they are engaged in a very intensive planning process right now, so we'll know more this fall. But if they can achieve their goal of getting up to 1,250 lead service line replacements every year, that's going to cost a lot of money. It's somewhat manageable, but it'll take 50 years. So the question is, what if because of EPA regulations or just because of recognition of the public health implications, a decision is made, no, we have to replace these 76,000 lead service lines in 5 or 10 years? That's when the numbers start to get very big and where the impact on ratepayers would get extremely big.
Well, so explain, why is MMSD equipment in comparatively good condition versus what we're finding with the Milwaukee Water Works?
I think that's a matter of how they plan.
One of the things that we note in the report, Mitch, is that MMSD has the benefit of sort of being a single mission jurisdiction. So if they're not taking care of their infrastructure, there's something really wrong there. Now, again, that doesn't mean that MWW and City DPW, Department of Public Works, get off the hook on that regard. But
they're just one part of a bigger whole.
Exactly. And there are so many different planning needs and capital needs that go above sewers and water mains and lead service lines, et cetera.
So the upshot for this is a pretty steep price tag.
In terms of the water reclamation facilities, assets, yes, we're looking at an increase in the next 5 years for that. And in this last budget, MMSD did spend a lot more on water reclamation facilities than they did on other assets.
But in terms of MWW, what are the funding mechanisms that are in place that would allow for the waterworks and the city and the DPW to be able to deal with the challenges that seem to be looming?
Well, and so the big distinction here is when we're talking about both city sewers and the Milwaukee Water Works, we're talking about ratepayers. So for the sewers, it's stormwater fees and sewer maintenance fees that are charged by the city to residents and to other property owners that will pay for those costs. And right now, in terms of the sewers, the plan is to try to do 27 miles of sewer lining and replacement per year. And they've actually been at above that level over the past 5 years because the major historic rainstorms of the 2009-2010 range caused them to do lots of additional work because some deficiencies were exposed. So that gets ramped down a little bit. In terms of the Milwaukee Water Works, what we are projecting here, or what they are projecting, is a huge surge in capital spending. Their capital budget has been in the range of $10 to $15 million per year. It's going to have to shoot up to more than $45 million per year. And so that's going to require the waterworks to do considerable borrowing, and the debt on that borrowing has to get repaid over 15-year periods. That's where they're going to have to go and petition the Public Service Commission for rate increases. And so that's the other wild card here. Whereas for the other entities, we are able to provide some information as to what this might mean in terms of the amount of the fee increases, we can't even project that because so much is going to be determined on what the PSC allows, how they allow them to depreciate certain assets, and other technical questions like that.
So these are issues, things like water and sewer service, that do not get a lot of attention unless there's a sudden crisis, generally speaking. In your experience, does something bad have to happen before people are willing to get behind a comprehensive plan to do something? Or is the fear of something bad happening enough, or maybe choice C, is the lead situation that something bad already?
Yeah, and I think it's a combination of all those things. I think this, as you know, is the second in a series of reports that we're doing on local government infrastructure. We also took a look at city streets and bridges and county trunk highways and buses. And I don't want to speak for Ben, but I think we're impressed with the way our local governments are assessing the condition of their infrastructure and putting forward plans to budget officials and ultimately elected officials that says, hey, this is what our goal should be. Unfortunately, where the rubber hits the road is that goal is having to be considered by budget and elected officials alongside goals for what should we be doing for our parks and cultural institutions, and what should we be doing for our city hall, which is undergoing a major project. So, the hope is that you're undergoing that regular investment so that you're going to not have a crisis. It seldom works out that way, and typically you're correct. It does take some type of a crisis situation, a recognition that we haven't been investing enough, that finally elevates some of these types of projects to the top, particularly given that they are underground.
These are literally underground.
Yes.
Yeah. And we've already talked about this, but the major rainfalls exposing deficiencies, things like that. I mean, MMSD, they're looking to protect against that as well all the time. They provide capital for inflow and infiltration monies to municipalities to prevent inflow and infiltration. So they're constantly trying to kind of avoid those problems.
Can you compare and contrast? You mentioned this is the second in a series of reports. Can you compare and contrast what you found in this report versus what you found in your look at the state of roads, bridges, buses, and other kind of transportation infrastructure?
Sure. I think starting with MMSD, I don't think there's any question that MMSD is in the best shape in terms of having a handle on very precisely what its multi-year needs are. and a plan to finance those needs. Now, it still doesn't mean in the end that the elected officials are going to, in this case, not elected officials, but the appointed commissioners to the MMSD commission. We point out in the report that, that taking care of those needs is going to require annual property tax increases of 4%. And on the one hand, you look at 4%, is that outrageous? I don't know that we'd say it's outrageous, but it's certainly at this point, it's above CPI. And going up 4% per year on the MMSD levy may be a political challenge in terms of getting the commission's approval. Turning now back to the city, I don't think there's any question that, that of the infrastructure we have looked at so far, MWW's situation is the most alarming. And again, this is not a reflection of the fact that they have been negligent, though it is worth noting that they have not had an overly ambitious capital improvement program over the past few years. But again, this lead service line issue emerged at the very same time that the water main situation in terms of the number of breakages that they were observing has caused the need to vastly expand their pace of replacement.
Thanks to both of you, and we'll keep looking at this issue.
Okay, thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Rob Henkin is president, and Ben Juarez is a researcher with the Milwaukee-based Public Policy Forum. You'll find a link to their report on the area's water and sewer infrastructure at WUWM.com.
A short break now, and then we'll learn about the effort to reduce the shortage of mental health nurses in the region. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. A few years ago, we learned that the state was facing a nursing shortage. It was due primarily to an aging population and an aging workforce. More recently, Lake Effect also reported on a local effort to help close that nursing gap through educating and graduating more nurses.
But within that context, the need for mental health nurses is especially great. The Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Division, BHD, launched a campaign this year to challenge existing professionals to remember why they became nurses and to encourage others to start careers in the mental health care field.
The new recruitment campaign profiles BHD nurses who share their reasons for entering the field of mental health nursing. V. Lucas is one of those nurses, and she and BHD Administrator Mike Lappin joined Audrey Nowakowski in the studio to talk about the campaign and why the need for mental health nurses is so prevalent in Milwaukee.
I think there's a lot of opportunity for nurses. So if you're providing services in an environment that may be a little more hectic, a little more challenging, I think there's a stigma around mental health and substance use that as far as dangerousness. So I think that stigma impacts us. I also just think it's not on anybody's radar today to be in this field and to provide these services. You know, I honestly sort of fell into this. I did an internship at a hospital and really a couple of weeks into this realized this was the career for me. And so, you know, we have to get the word out that this is an option. This is a career. And I think once folks meet some of our staff or really see what we do and have that experience, they're going to be lifers too.
Do you think that any previous practices contributed to the shortage, either in Milwaukee or abroad, if people went about it the wrong way or if they've heard bad stories or negative news about mental health nursing?
I believe that for us particularly, the biggest factor is this belief that we're closing, that we're not a long-term option. And so I think in an environment where there's great competition, you can understand why if I have five offers, I'm going to go to the place that's going to be for sure there in the future. And I think that's been a challenge in that even though we really don't have any immediate timetable for any change in our delivery system, I mean, we have, you know, there'll at least be a couple of years where we're operating just at status quo. There is this perception that we already closed. And if we haven't already closed, others are like, well, you guys are closing, right? You know, it's just this general perception in the community. And I think that's a big factor for us. I also, just my observation more globally, is that the sort of helper professions are just not seen as a great career. And I think it's really just people don't know that. They don't understand that it's great pay, great benefits, really sort of creative scheduling and staffing. And we have a lot of flexibility that other industries don't have. We're open 24/7. We're open every holiday, you know. And I think as an industry, we do better, benefits are better, more vacation, better health plans, all these things. But I don't think people really get that, especially the younger folks.
Now, V, your career is very much centered around helping others. So what are some of the challenges you deal with as a mental health nurse compared to other nursing colleagues who are perhaps in a different field of nursing?
In regards to challenges, I'm working with the most vulnerable people in our community. A lot of times the people that organizations may push away. So we're working on a daily basis with the homeless. We have a huge crisis in our city when it comes to homelessness, and I see homeless people every day. We're also working with people with AODA issues, such as alcoholism and substance abuse. So that's a huge challenge in itself, because you're not only working with these people, but you're also working with their families. And it's in a broader sense. You can't just focus on the person. You're focusing on all the lives that this one person may affect. This person with substance abuse issues, it's not just that person. It's that person's children. It's that person's wife. And, you know, it just goes beyond just the person. Also, we're working with people who experience traumatic events. One of the most powerful, I guess, examples I can give is one night I encountered a man that came in, and he had just lost his wife in a car accident. It literally just happened within minutes before him coming to us. Unfortunately, they were in a drunk driver situation. And so literally this man is covered with blood from his wife. And I was his first point of contact. So, I mean, how challenging is that in itself? That's one of the most traumatic events that can happen in a person's life. And I'm the first person that that man is talking to. I'm there to de-escalate that man, and I'm there to try to give him hope, encouragement, and tell him that you're not alone. So, I don't know. I've never heard of any of my friends talking about something as powerful as that, as being there for people when they absolutely need you the most. And I have the opportunity to do that on a nightly basis. So I guess I would say that's challenging in itself.
Absolutely. And with those types of situations, you're not going to typically encounter that on a routine route in a hospital or things like that.
No.
So with mental health nursing, did you have to go through additional requirements and training needed to care for this specific population, these especially vulnerable people?
Yes, we have an awesome orientation program. It's a pretty long program, but we have a lot. We have classroom. So we're learning about different mental illnesses. So we're, you know, schizophrenics, your bipolar, your borderline patients. So we're learning about how to treat the person. And also these people, a lot of times when you have mental illness, you're also carrying on other types of ailments as well. So these people, a lot of times, aren't taking care of their healthcare needs. So you may have a person that comes in and they haven't been on their medications as far as psychiatric, but that means they also may have not been taking their medications for, say, diabetes. So it's treating that whole person, and we learn to do that in that classroom aspect. Also, we have MANT training, so we're trained on how to de-escalate a patient if a patient becomes upset. We learn how to work one-on-one as a team. It's very much a team environment. So we're working with our security that's on board. We're working with our doctors. Our doctors are right there with me. So that's really nice that I have, if I need something, I'm able to say, hey, you know, right there, I need your support, and they're there for me. So it's very team oriented. And we learn that in class, that you very much, it's not just you, but it's a collaboration of professionals working as one to treat these patients.
How did you come into this career in the first place?
So I'm going to be totally honest. I never, ever thought I would be a mental health nurse. When I walked out of school, I wanted to be a labor and delivery nurse. That's what I wanted to do. You know, in college, to be honest, mental health wasn't really promoted. I didn't even have a mental health rotation. I ended up working a little bit in mental health through, I was a CNA prior to nursing, so I had some experience that way, but I never even had a rotation in psychiatric care. So I applied for the job. I seen that there's an open position for the county, and I said, oh, you know, why not? I need a job. I got to pay back my student loans, so let's give it a shot, you know, let's try it. And I got the call back. I got the interview, and I was offered the job right away, and they said, We'd like to place you in psychiatric crisis services. And I'm nodding and smiling. Okay. You're not, not necessarily knowing what I was agreeing to, but it's a decision that I would never take back ever. I absolutely love my job. I love going to work every day. Every day is a new day. There's no 2 days the same. There's no 2 patients the same. So it's the challenge that I need in my life, and it's always exciting. I'm never bored at work. It's not routine at all. And that's what I love about what I do.
You mentioned that you take care of the person as a whole, both the mental and the physical ailments. Do you think it's more effective to deal with it in this manner, or do you think it'd be beneficial to have more nurses with specialties working together? Or is the team-centric environment that you have at BHD something that other medical institutions should take note of?
I think the team-centered environment is pretty effective, and we're pretty efficient with treating that whole person. If there's things that we are not trained to do, because we are a psychiatric hospital, we work hand-in-hand with our community hospitals. So, for example, you get a patient who comes in and their blood sugar is 350 and it's untreated. They haven't been on their medications. Well, we will send out those patients out to a medical facility. They will be treated, and then they will come back to us, and then we will treat them in regards to their psychiatric needs. So we work hand-in-hand with community resources.
And Mike, you mentioned that this job isn't for everyone, but what are the goals regarding BHD and this campaign and going forward in bringing your ideal candidates for nursing?
Well, the goal, ideal target group here would be younger nurses, people who are just starting out, recent graduates from, you know, we talked about the millennials or the Generation Y folks who are earlier in their careers, impressionable folks that we can really teach about our models. And then also the second career students. Some folks are coming out of another career. They went back to school. I think the word is getting out that nursing is a industry where opportunities abound. And so it's very important for us to connect with those folks. The folks coming into this field with lots of life experience have a ton to offer for our consumers and for our their colleagues. So the idea is to bring more people in. And again, really, it's about getting the word out about this industry and about our field, and really trying to find those folks that, once people experience what V has described in her day-to-day world, it's hard to give that up. And I think that's what you find in this industry, is you have folks who do this for 30 years and couldn't imagine doing anything else. We want to find those high-quality folks that couldn't imagine doing anything else once they are exposed to it.
Outside of your call to action, something that a better and well-supplied mental health care facility and staff and nursing can obviously aid the community it serves. So anything to add to that, V? How do you want to see your work turned around and go beyond the hospital doors?
I would say upon discharge, my goal for the patient that I am helping at that moment is that they will leave with the resources they need to live a productive life, the resources they need to bring them happiness. So that, I guess that would be my goal as a nurse, is that I never want someone to leave and have questions, or I never want someone to leave and still be wondering, what do I do now? I want to try to answer those questions before they leave me.
Well, V. Lucas and Mike Lappin, thank you both for coming in and for the work that you do.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Mike Lappin is the Milwaukee County Behavioral Health Division Administrator, and V. Lucas is a part-time mental health nurse for the county. They spoke with Audrey Nowakowski in March.
We'll take another quick break, and then a very meta topic. Book critic turned author Jim Higgins talks about his book about authors. Wisconsin authors, to be precise. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. We're back with more of Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Many of us know Jim Higgins as the books editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, so it's safe to say that he writes a lot, especially in the form of book reviews. But his latest project is a book that someone else will have to review.
It's called Wisconsin Literary Luminaries, and it's Higgins' first book. It's a collection of 10 essays about some of the state's most famous writers, from Laura Ingalls Wilder to Ayad Akhtar. Higgins talks about the book Wednesday evening at the Whitefish Bay Public Library, but he's with us first to explain how he chose the writers he did.
The History Press is a publisher of local and regional books, and they do tiny little markets, niches, sub-niches, and they had done a book on Tennessee writers with a similar title, and they came to me and said, Jim, would you be interested in doing one on Wisconsin writers? And I looked at the Tennessee book, and I thought about it, and I said, yes, if I could do it this way, and they said, okay. But one practical thing is their books come in between 30 and 50,000 words. So I sized it up and realized I could fit 10 writers comfortably in this. And then I made a list, and I looked at a lot of places that had lists of Wisconsin writers because I had a morbid fear of forgetting somebody really important and having somebody smart like you say to me, Jim,
how come
you forgot about Shakespeare? He's a Wisconsin writer. And
it's the little known part of the canon.
That's right. Two gentlemen from Verona, Verona, Wisconsin.
Exactly.
And really and truthfully, one of the helpful lists of Wisconsin writers is at the Central Library in downtown Milwaukee, where they have the Wisconsin Writers Wall of Fame. And that was a list I kept coming back to every once in a while as I thought about who. And then in the journalism world, and I'm sure you've done this, Bonnie, too, we can have a very loose definition of who's from Wisconsin. You know, there are people who were born here, people who lived here. We're always shocking our boss, who's from New Jersey, with the Wisconsin connections of various people you'd never think about. So Saul Bellow spent a year at the University of Wisconsin. Could we claim him, you know, if we wanted to? Well, that's pretty specious. So I decided...
I noticed he wasn't in the book.
He wasn't in the book because I thought not even I have the chutzpah to pull that off. I decided they had to be either born here or spent significant time here doing significant work here. And I kept whittling down my list. And then the other factor was it had to be someone that I felt I could say something of value of. There are writers from Wisconsin that I just didn't really think I could bring you something of value, so there's not much point of me writing about them. So they fell into four groups. I have four pillars, I call them, four just great writers from this state who we have to talk about. Laura Ingalls Wilder, you know, who didn't live here very long, but her first book is set here. And I think in a certain sense, she set a tone for what people think about Wisconsin. Thornton Wilder, you know, the most celebrated writer born in Wisconsin, Thornton Wilder, the author of Our Town and The Skin of Our Teeth. Aldo Leopold, who came here as a young man and really worked out much of his environmental and ecological philosophy here in what's a pretty well-written book. If he hadn't been as good a writer as he was, I don't know if his ideas would have spread as widely as they did. And Laureen Niedecker, who is a great poet from Wisconsin and a really interesting study of a fairly isolated woman, you know, determinedly writing. And I should also say really well celebrated by her hometown of Fort Atkinson. So those are the four pillars. And then when it came to living writers, because this is a book that's mostly sold in Wisconsin, I wanted people who still had a strong connection here and also had at least one classic. And I'll define classic as either something you study in school or something that is going to be read after you're gone. So Larry Watson, Montana, 1948, a classic. My daughter read it in high school. Lots of kids all around the world read it in high school. And I think many people don't know he actually lives in Milwaukee. Only one of his books is set in Wisconsin, but he's a Milwaukee writer now.
Yeah, he's been on this show a couple of times.
And a fascinating guy. Mm-hmm. And his Wisconsin book is an really interesting one. Jane Hamilton, a tremendous writer from Wisconsin. And most of her works are set in this state. And her most recent novel is a wonderful Wisconsin coming-of-age story. Michael Perry, Population 485, is a classic. And I liken it to Our Town in my book. I think they have much in common and will be continue to be widely read for that reason.
Does Michael Perry like the fact that you compared him to Thornton Wilder?
I don't know. We'll see. I mean, yeah. I'm not sure how. I think Michael Perry,
I would be honored.
I think Michael Perry likes people reading his work, so yeah. I hope in some way it will help other people find it. And if you ever talk to a nurse who reads, they've all read Population 45 and most of his other work. And then Ayad Akhtar, who's a brilliant writer, playwright from Wisconsin. And while he doesn't live here now, he has a strong relationship with the state. The rep is doing his work. And very interesting and happy to me, after the book came out, on the rep's next season, we have Our Town and Akhtar's The Who and the What. And then in the middle of this sandwich, two writers from Milwaukee who have really strong cult followings, but I think deserve wider ones. And one is Ellen Raskin, who wrote The Westing Game and a number of other books for children, but are beloved by adults, and Cordwainer Smith. If you're not a science fiction fan, you might not know his name, but he was born in Milwaukee. And
that was a nom de plume,
right? It was a nom de plume, yeah, for Paul Leinberger. If you know Bayview, that little street, Leinberger Terrace, his father developed that area and is named for his family. He's a really unusual man, but he's also one of the great stylists of the 50s and early 60s in science fiction. And science fiction writers today strongly acknowledge both his talent and his influence. So I hope I came up with a grouping that'll have something for most readers and some discoveries for readers, too.
Yeah, something where you can read about the things that you talked about and say, huh, you know, I'd like to read more of that writer's,
yes,
work. I mean, I have read some of everybody. Of course, I grew up on the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. And before I knew where Wisconsin was, because I'm from New England,
right,
but we had big woods, too. And so, yeah, I recognized something about that even when I was, you know, 8, 10, whenever it was that I was reading those books. And so, you know, she was just such a pivotal writer for so many young girls of our generation and today. I mean, I find that amazing. And as you say, Leopold, the thing in your essay that which really drew me was when he shot the wolf.
Yes.
And he,
yes,
and he found, he was told he had to write about it. He had to bring that in, and it changed him.
Yes. His friend was saying, well, you have to be honest about that moment. And what I find fascinating, considering him, his whole life and his whole career as a writer, although I don't know that he thought of himself as a writer, I think he thought of the writing as an important part of his work of education, was you see the man change and grow and his vision expand. And he started as a forester, and he wanted to— his side project was making sure there was a supply of game animals for hunters. And by the end, and he would not have wanted me to call him a prophet, but he can't defend himself here. So he was a prophet. By the end of his life, he's a prophet. He's talking about the value of wilderness for the sake of wilderness and biodiversity and humans in an equal partnership with the land. Those are really still radical ideas to many people.
So as you have brought this book out and you've read now some, you've been at Boswell,
right,
with folks, mm-hmm, you're about to be at the Whitefish Bay Public Library reading this. What are people saying to you? What are readers saying to you as they have explored your book?
Everybody wants to know how I picked them. And I don't necessarily take that as criticism. I think that's curiosity because it's a small book, not a giant book. People ask about, it's kind of like with the NCAA tournament. People want to, who was on the bubble? You know, who didn't make the cut? And one person I always say is Lois Ehlert. And I would love to have included Lois, but this is a black and white book. And I didn't see much sense in writing about a person whose work is color picture books in a black and white book. So she's in my appendix. But a point I make there is I think when people write about literary things, it's easy to forget about books for children. But you just explained very eloquently how powerful that reading is. You know, after Laura Ingalls Wilder, the writer most people listening to this would likely have encountered is Lois Ehlert, you know, either reading them as kids or read them to their kids. And so I think it's really important to write about literature for kids on a continuum with literature for adults. Most of the other little conversations I've had about the book have been about the writers people like. You know, people want to talk about Laura Ingalls Wilder because, you know, she affected so many people and so many people love the book and the TV show. I was extremely delighted to discover this very quiet guy, and I would have no sense of what he read was a big Cordwainer Smith fan. And I thought, wow, there's one other guy besides me in the wild who's heard of him. And
I have to say, I'm a science fiction fan, and I didn't really know his name. So that was a discovery for me.
Well, and Bonnie, that's partly a publishing history thing, you know, that he wrote in the pulp or post-pulp era, and the work languished for a while. And because he only wrote one decent but not great novel, and most of his work is in stories, it's not like Heinlein or Asimov or people who wrote great novels and they've been kept continuously in print. It's taken the New England Science Fiction Association, which has a really marvelous publishing program, to get those stories back in print. But it's also a slightly hard to find mail order book. For example, bookstores can't get it on the usual terms they get most big publishers' books. So it's harder to find the work. You almost have to run into it in an anthology or online somewhere. And as I said, my book, I've compared it in some ways to liner notes, you know, to encourage people what they're reading. And then the other day I said, it's like a K-Tel album, you know, puts a bunch of old hits out there and you can see what you like and don't like. So
I have to say, you're just dating yourself there.
Yes, thank you. Well, you know, I remember I said I was the older twin.
You were. And, you know, and of course I knew immediately what you were talking about. And
or maybe it's like, now that's what I call Wisconsin literature, to do that little, now that's what I call music series. Maybe
yes.
That's the more 21st century example.
Of it,
yes.
Or a little, yeah, it's a podcast of a bunch of different,
exactly.
Different things. Are you hoping that people will rediscover some of these folks or discover them if they didn't know about them in the first place?
Oh, certainly. I mean, I envision this as a book that would be in the library that students or people would look, if students still look in the library. I mean, their verdict's out on that. But I know libraries are really busy because everyone I've been in has been full of people and often full of young people. Yes, I hope it will lead people to read other things. That is my goal. I don't think 100 years from now there'll be brilliant essays about what I wrote here. But I do hope in the coming years it will encourage people to pick up and read other things, or maybe to stay with a work they find interesting but just need a little nudge along the way.
What about a novel or a collection of short stories from you? Is that in the works at all, or you're happy with essays?
There is a half-finished novel from many years ago. I don't know that it will get finished. I'm kind of open to see doing this, and I'm 58, so I'm not exactly young in the writing department.
Laura Ingalls Wilder, as you point out, was 65.
Amen.
Yeah.
Amen. I think any writer needs the dream or the idea strong enough to carry them through the labor of the work. So I've had other ideas. We'll see where they might lead. I rarely reveal this in public, but over the years, as Borges, one of my heroes, would say, you know, every man on occasion might have 10 or 8 or 10 opportunities where they're a poet, and there have been for me. Would I ever pull them all together? Would anybody be interested in them? You know, we'll see. Now that I've done it once, it has occurred to me, oh yeah, I could do this again. And I have thought about a collection about writers from my hometown of Pittsburgh, which is a remarkable variety of people. And it runs from Stephen Foster, the American songwriter, who's from my actual neighborhood, to August Wilson. But we'll see.
Well, whatever you come up with, come back and talk to us about it.
Amen.
All right. Jim Higgins, it's been such a pleasure.
Thank you, Bonnie. And thanks for doing what you do for reading culture in Milwaukee.
Jim Higgins is arts and books editor for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. His first book that he wrote is called Wisconsin Literary Luminaries, From Laura Ingalls Wilder to Ayad Akhtar. He'll talk about it Wednesday evening at the Whitefish Bay Public Library.
We'll take one last break, and then musician and podcast producer Mike Mangione talks about Bob Dylan and Levon Helm with a pair of musicians who shared the stage with both of them. You're listening to Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio.
Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Mike Mangione is a Milwaukee area musician, but he's also the host and producer of an artist-to-artist interview podcast called Time and the Mystery. We talk with Mike every month about one of the notable interviews he's done with musicians, actors, and other people of note.
Mike joined us in the studio recently to share some of a remarkable conversation he had with two musicians, his link to a couple of longtime musical heroes of his. Nice to see you as always.
It's really nice to be in your office today.
It's nice to have you here. We're talking today about an interview you did with a couple of musicians mm-hmm. who I don't know that they're household names for those of us outside the music industry, but I gather these two folks are people who are really well known and really well respected inside the world of what you do.
Sure, yeah. So Larry Campbell and Teresa Williams, they're a married couple, and they have their own duo going that's fantastic. They're called the King and Queen of Americana Music. But Larry Campbell first came to me through Bob Dylan. I'm a huge Dylan and Levon Helm fan. And Larry Campbell was, I remember I was at Marquette University and I went to go see Bob Dylan at one of the theaters downtown. And I mean, he's a great songwriter. His performance is great. But what Dylan does so well is he builds a band around him that, frankly, can carry him through a full show with a very limited vocal range. I remember one year is during the 90s, like late 90s, and Dylan had two guitarists that just absolutely made the show so colorful and so dynamically large. It was Larry Campbell and Charlie Sexton. And so I've always had my eye on Larry Campbell. I've always appreciated his work as a guitarist. Well, he left when he worked with Dylan for like 7-8 years, recorded one of my favorite Dylan records, which is Love and Theft, which unfortunately came out on September 11th, 2001. But he left Dylan's band and joined Levon Helm. And not only became Levon Helm's guitarist, he became Levon Helm's producer for the three records that Levon won a Grammy with, and became the music director for what's called The Ramble, which was Levon was doing shows at his barn at his house. Levon's health was deteriorating, and so he opened up his barn. He made it into a venue, opened it up for people to come. About 150, 200 people would come, pay a nice ticket price, and sit like pretty much on top of the band as they would play all night. And these shows were supposed to be amazing.
And that is where your conversation begins.
I've never been, but from what it looks like and what it sounds like, it's such a unique situation. I mean, it's literally the heart of something special. Yeah. And you enter into the heart.
That was Levon's heart.
Levon's heart.
Yeah.
Yeah. Was that, do you think that was the dream from the very beginning? That kind of creating that heart, that home?
I don't think it was
home.
Consciously no. that. I think it was something that he couldn't help because he was so...
He was that.
He was. It was that. I mean, I always keep saying there was no distance between who Levon was and what he did.
That sounds... You know? That's so great to hear.
Yeah.
As a fan, because that's what you think.
Right.
But you never
right.
know.
Yeah, sure.
No.
He had his human flaws, as we all do, you know.
Yeah,
But he... there was an honesty to his soul that was just, he tripped over it, you know? He couldn't help it. It was there, and there was nothing he could do about it.
And that's a big magnet, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
I mean, people wanted to be around him and be with him. And
feel like they know him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he made everybody feel like you were his best friend, you know? It just, everybody felt close to him, I think. Yeah.
How do you maintain that after?
How do you maintain
I don't know. How did he maintain his Arkansas accent for 40 years?
And there wasn't anything put on about it either. It was the real, it sounded like he walked out of the cotton patch, you know, the day.
Just the authenticity.
Yeah. Authenticity.
And heart. Authenticity.
So tell me a little bit about how this interview came about.
This is the first person that I've interviewed that I walked in. I was in their neck of the woods. I was in Albany, New York. It was before one of their shows, and I was so nervous because I look up to these people so much. And I open up the dressing room door, and there they are. And my heart starts racing like a geek. You know, like I'm so like I'm dorking out here. But we have a mutual friend, and it's my old producer, a guy named Bo Ramsey. Bo Ramsey has worked with Larry Campbell on some stuff. And so to level the playing field, the first thing I say to him is I said, Bo Ramsey says hello. And he's nice. He then opens up and I was like, ah, okay. So this was unique because we had to, I wanted to know so much about them and their work. But at the same time, I also wanted to know about who they worked with. And so they jumped right in talking about Levon Helm, and I was very happy to do so. And they started talking about the Rambles and what made the Rambles so special and what made Levon so special.
So that's a musician interviewing two musicians about a fourth musician.
Yeah.
But they also talked about their own work, right?
Yeah. So at this point now in the conversation, I'm totally comfortable. And what I loved about them is they you know, they're talking about Levon having authenticity. Well, they have it in spades. And they really take their work seriously. And so do I. And with what I do in everything. And so we start talking about, well, how do you then, you know, we're not just like licking stamps here. We're trying to actually have a connection with an audience, you know. We entered into their work and talking about their performance and how they make that connection and what we start calling, how do they get out of the way? How do they not become distracted by themselves so they can be authentic to the people they're in front of?
You know what helps is getting on stage and knowing that these people are here with open hearts to have a good time and to hear what you want to communicate to them.
Yeah.
And you owe it to them to get out of your own way and let them have that.
But yeah. That's a trick, getting out of your own way. That's an accomplishment.
But when I consciously am aware that people have come here to because they and they're paying money to get this from you, I can look at that as a responsibility and completely disown whatever personal issues I'm wrapped up with.
Yeah, it's not about you.
You're right. That's right. That's right.
It's not about you.
It's about what I have to give to these people and what they come to get from me.
Yeah, they're given back by receiving. Exactly. It's a cyclical. Yes. I had a moment once, and this was like the most like I snapped right in. Like the fastest way I snapped into it is when I was singing. I think I was playing solo, and I noticed a couple people. You know, you notice everything. People moving or. The worst is the phone. If you see a phone go, oh yeah. No! And I was so thrown out of it. And I was like, what must I do to like make these people listen, to make them happy? What must I do to like get into that place? And then my eyes turned right to a woman with her eyes closed, and I realized she's doing nothing but listening to everything that I'm doing right now, and not in like an egotistical way,
right?
But in like
right.
Yeah. What's being laid out is being completely received by yes. one person. Yeah. And if it's only one person, that's enough for me.
That's yeah. enough for
yeah.
me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Teresa Williams and Larry Campbell in conversation with Mike Mangione and a little bit of music there as well. As you mentioned, though, Larry Campbell not only worked with Levon Helm, before that, he worked with Bob Dylan.
Yeah, and so I'm just all transparency in this conversation, I'm chomping at the bit to get into Dylan, right? But I want to be respectful. I know that Dylan's very secretive, and there's some people that I know that have worked with, and they can't talk about the experience. But Larry opened up the door, and so we start talking about Dylan before his like he would play 200 dates a year, and before his shows, each show he would have like a 2-hour rehearsal before each show. And so moving along in the whole theme of how to maintain authenticity and connection, Larry starts talking about Dylan's process in doing that and how he, you know, after all these years, maintains sanity and connection with his audience.
We would play songs over and over and over again until we got to something that was sort of a new interpretation of that same old song to him.
Do you mean play it over and over again every night?
In rehearsals.
Okay,
in rehearsals or sound checks, you know. Mm-hmm. And it would sort of develop this characteristic. It wouldn't be performed that way if it hadn't been for the particular members of that band performing it that way, mm-hmm. you know. He would keep kneading the dough, as it were, until it got to where it was something that was speaking to him.
Would it be consistent then from that point on?
Or for a while.
Really?
Yeah, for a while. And then it would morph into something else.
Do you think, like for me as a writer and a performer, that to me says, I would think he's just trying to stay close to the source.
Yeah, exactly.
Not cast
yes.
up.
Yes, yes.
Give
yes.
an honest.
Which is what we've been talking about.
What we're talking about.
Right, that's right.
Oh, man.
That's very true.
Just, you got to respect that.
It's yeah. a beautiful thing.
And the audience may not always be happy that it's not exactly the way they've heard yeah. it. And then, you know.
Oh, totally.
But. Yeah. He's searching. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like to me. Who am I to say? Yeah. But
so you're having this conversation with them, and they're in their dressing room in Albany, New York. But I gather you also had a chance to kind of share your personal reflections about a connection you made with them.
Yeah, definitely. And let me just say that, you know, these little segments you're showing are me talking with them. We do talk about their work quite a bit in the actual podcast. So if you want to know about them a little more, not just Levon Helm and Dylan, you can. But I had a moment. Levon Helm toured right before he died. I saw him at the Potawatomi Casino on March 14th. He died a month later, and he had maybe five more shows from when I saw him in Milwaukee to before he died. So he was touring right to the last moment. I had a profound moment watching that show as the last song they did, where I was moved more by any live performance I've ever seen in my life, and I've seen a lot. So I had, and I share what that moment is in the actual podcast if you want to hear it, but I had the honor of being moved by these people and then in this interview tell them about the experience I had with their work. And it opened up a door for them. They then start sharing their last experiences with Levon. And so this is a story of their last show with Levon, a man who played music for 40 years. And, you know, this is them talking about his last show ever.
He said, I think it was the last show, road show that we did with him. It was Tarrytown Music Hall. We're backstage in a little kind of barely there dressing room, and he's sitting with his head down and everybody's getting ready to go out, and there's only like, I don't know, three or four maybe of us in that dressing room, and he looks up and goes, because his voice was really raggedy, he had hardly been able to sing at all recently at that time, and he looked up suddenly, and I don't know if anybody else heard him, but he said, all I ask for are those 2 hours on stage.
Wow.
It was heavy. And that night, he picked up on When I Go Away, which Larry had been having to sing because Levon couldn't sing it. Larry did like a phrase.
I did the first verse.
And
I'm about to come in on the second verse.
And he picked it up.
And here comes this voice, like out of nowhere.
Ringing.
Which hadn't been around for a while. Singing it clear as a bell, and with all this strength
he had in him.
And he finished the song.
I thought we were all going to levitate.
Yeah. It was, just, and it's on YouTube. And then we came out and did Glory Land after that. And it was the last song we all sang with him, right there.
Yeah. What a great song.
Oh, yeah.
What a great moment.
Teresa Williams and Larry Campbell talking about the last time they played with Levon Helm on the road. Mike, thanks for bringing us that conversation.
Thank you for letting me share it.
One more time. One more time. I feel like I'm returning.
Mike Mangione is a Milwaukee area singer-songwriter. He joins us every month to share some of the highlights from his podcast, which is called Time and the Mystery. You'll find a link to his full conversation with Larry Campbell and Teresa Williams at WUWM.com.
And Larry Campbell and Teresa Williams take us out for the Monday edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Please be with us again tomorrow and every weekday morning at 10 for Lake Effect. It's here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock and fresh air comes your way next.